Hey, everybody, it's Maureen here. Thanks so much for listening to season 3 of On a Mission. It's been my pleasure to bring you the voices of Gabrielle and Neha, and today, Abby, Catholic activist and writer. She's tremendous. But this week, I wanted to take a pause and ask you to take my 2021 survey. I'm so interested in getting your ideas for more content that you'd be interested in, including guests for this podcast, courses I'm ready to offer, as well as writing projects. Find the link to my reader survey in the show notes for this episode. You can also get the link right now at MaureenDupreeDominguez.com/survey. Thanks again for listening and for being a part of things around here in this growing space. And now, on with the show. This is On a Mission, episode 21. This is a space where I get real and go deep with my guests. They're all folks who are living out their callings, paying close attention to their lives, and each doing so with special flair. I'm your host, Maureen Dupree-Dominguez. I'm a minister, teacher, writer, and general people enthusiast. And I can't wait to share some of these thought-provoking people with you, folks who are ready to get real and go deep. Abby Rampone is the Communication and Activities Coordinator for Call to Action USA. It's an organization dedicated to reform in the Catholic Church. She grew up in a Catholic family in Vermont, but really became committed to her faith while in college, so much so that she felt called to attend seminary. She just finished her Master of Divinity degree in 2020, and now she's committed to working full-time for change in the Catholic Church. Call to Action wants to see full inclusion of LGBTQ+ individuals in the Catholic community, ordination justice for all genders, and anti-racist actions and words from the top down in Catholic communities. We talked about her involvement with Dorothy Day's community, Mary House, in New York City, the Regeneration Project to activate young people in the work of Call to Action, and why she says activists should not forget about charity when working for change. Listen in. Abby Rampone, welcome to On a Mission.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're super excited to hear from you. You are a scholar, an activist, a feminist Catholic socialist. Yeah.
I would more call myself an anarchist, but anarchism is within the tradition of socialism.
Let's start there. So tell us, what does it mean to you to be a Catholic anarchist?
So when I discovered the Catholic worker movement while I was at seminary, I felt like everything clicked into place. I had been involved with a lot of social justice circles in college, and I was attending a progressive divinity school. I went to Union Theological Seminary in New York. But when I first went downtown, went to the East Village and visited Mary House, one of the two Catholic worker houses in the city, I felt like everything just sort of fit together all of a sudden for me. The Catholic worker synthesis of a very radical politics, firmly grounded in the gospel, the philosophy that's built up around it, that's been developed by some really serious thinkers in the 20th century, and which really traces its roots back much further, of course. I just thought, you know, this is where I want to ground myself. This is what makes sense to me. So the Catholic worker tradition, its emphasis on smallness, on radical hospitality, on resistance to capitalism and to the state. From reading Dorothy Day's writings, from studying the history of the movement, I just sort of realized that this is where I wanted to be. And it wasn't only because of the philosophy, it was also because of the people. So it just kind of all fell into place for me.
So awesome. In your experience, What is it about the Catholic worker way that so closely exemplifies the teachings of Jesus?
Well, I think that in a lot of the radical spaces that I had been in, especially in academic spaces, there was a way that people sort of looked down on charity. Charity was considered sort of insufficiently radical. So if you were going out and working in a soup kitchen, you weren't a real radical, you know? A real radical had to be railing against the system. A real radical had to be analyzing the ways that race intersected with capitalism, intersected with environmental degradation, all of those things, right? So there was a sort of dichotomy constructed. Mm-hmm. And the Catholic worker is doing systemic analysis, right? The Catholic worker is looking at the ways that race and capital and all of these systems oppress people, but it's also materially addressing them. And that's what was missing for me, because that's what I think the Gospels are doing, right? The Gospels are very, very material. They're very, very grounded in actual acts of service. And I don't think charity should be a dirty word. I mean, charity just means love. And even though it's been sort of co-opted by sort of the nonprofit complex, doesn't mean that that's what it has to be. So the Catholic worker really emphasizes personalism, which means that you have this obligation to directly serve the person who's in front of you. So, you know, you're walking down the street, you see a person who doesn't have a coat on. You don't call up the social service agency and tell them, hey, there's a person who needs your help. You should come here and give them a coat. You give them your coat. And that's what Jesus did, right? that's what we saw in the gospel. We saw acts of service, helping an individual person, loving an individual person in front of you. And then, of course, connecting that love and that direct service to the larger systems that made that person suffer, right?
Yes.
But there's no dichotomy. So that's why I think that's what the Catholic worker is doing, that I think that a lot of the activist spaces, both secular and liberal, that I'd been in before weren't doing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Kind of content to live in the headspace, the analysis space, the shouting at the system space, as opposed to the heart and hand space.
Exactly. Yeah. And both of them have a place, but if you go way too much into the headspace, then I feel like you're sort of abdicating your responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Abby, what made you go to divinity school?
That's a great question. So I went to a secular liberal arts college. I never planned to study religion or get involved with religious community. I had been raised in a devout Catholic family, but going to Mass felt like a routine to me. It was what we did every week. It was an important part of our week, but I didn't have a very in-depth understanding of what it meant. I didn't have a very personal relationship to it. So I went off to college. I was a writer. I wanted to study foreign languages. And I sort of accidentally ended up making friends with people who were getting involved with a new interfaith group on campus. They were the co-founders of this new group. And they sort of brought me in. I always say to them that I didn't want to go to the first meeting in my freshman year. It was an organizational meeting. I wasn't that interested, but I went along with them. And that group became sort of my grounding community in college. I made my really, really close friends through that interfaith community, through an extended community that gathered in a common room in the basement of the college chapel. It was an interfaith common room. And it was really special. My closest friends were women of other religious backgrounds. So I kind of had this core close group of friends, one of whom was a Muslim woman from the United Arab Emirates. The other was a Latina woman who was converting to Islam. And the other was a Lutheran woman, a white Lutheran woman. And it was through them that I really started thinking more critically and sort of reclaiming my Catholicism and developing an adult relationship with it. And then my Lutheran friend, who was a few years ahead of me in college, when she graduated, she went off to seminary. So she wanted to be a pastor. And I got jealous. I thought, you know, why does she get to basically go off after college and continue doing this stuff? The stuff that I had really fallen in love with, the interfaith work that we were doing in this club, because it was about the friendships, but it was also about the dinners that we had and the activism that we did and the sort of college organizing that we participated in, both in religious spaces and in secular spaces. So I was jealous that she was going to go off and do that. And in this couple of years between when she graduated and when I graduated, I realized that I could do it too. I had a mentor. The chaplain to the college was a Presbyterian, and he'd gotten a degree from Union Theological Seminary, and I learned a little bit about it from him, and he was just an inspiration to me in so many different ways. He was a real pastoral presence in my personal life and just like a model to me in the way that he built community on campus. He built a ecumenical, primarily mainline Protestant dinner church essentially on campus that I participated in my last few years, but he was sort of just a beloved figure on campus and people really looked up to him. And he shared with me about things that he had experienced as an older man, an older gay man who had to spend much of his ministry closeted because his church did not ordain openly gay people until much later in his life. Mm. So from him sharing about that, I related as a Catholic woman, as somebody who could not participate fully in my church's ordained ministry. So I developed this connection with him. I learned about his journey, and I basically decided I wanted to do what my friend had done, going off to seminary. I wanted to do the same thing. And it wasn't really that I had a concrete sense of what the career options would be. It was just that I wanted to continue to be in that space. I wanted to study religion in an academic context. I only took a few religion classes in undergrad. And I only applied to Union. I wanted to go to New York. I wanted to be in a place that had a strong focus on interreligious engagement, which Union does, and a strong commitment to justice. So that's what I did.
Awesome. There are people who are listening who maybe are like, well, you've done so much hanging around with people who are Protestant, people who are Muslim, people who are of other denominations, other faiths. It might make a person think, well, that would make you run screaming from Catholicism. But it actually sounds like it has done the opposite, that it made you more Catholic.
Oh, absolutely.
Is that an accurate assessment? And can you explain that phenomenon?
Yeah, totally. Well, I feel like I said, with my friends in college, they were sort of going through their own versions of struggle with their traditions, struggles with what they had inherited. So we had that in common. So we could talk about that. And then being at Union, being in a place that was deliberately religious, unlike my college, but which was not Catholic, really forced me to develop a stronger, even stronger sense of myself as a Catholic. So at Union, it's primarily mainline Protestant. There are there's a significant number of non-Christian students. There are growing programs in Islam and in Buddhism. There are sort of nuns, quote unquote, non-religiously affiliated students. But there's no, even though mainline Protestants generally are the majority, there's no single majority. So for Catholics, there's probably the maximum number of Catholics that were ever there at Union while I was there was about 10. And for most of the time that I was there, it was fewer than that. So I didn't have a lot of Catholic peers, although I had a few Catholic professors. And I needed to figure out what it meant to be Catholic. And everybody in seminary is kind of trying to figure out what it means to be a person of faith. but doing that around a bunch of mainline Protestants, many of whom are going to get ordained, was challenging in a way that, but and it was in a way that made me dig my heels in. So, there were some people who got it, right? Who were wrestling with the same things as me. And with them, we could have a conversation. And then there were some people who brought in their preconceptions about Catholicism and said things that upset me or frustrated me or things that were just sort of ignorant, not usually with bad intentions, but things that were frustrating. So I was in a weird place of like defending Catholicism sometimes, which is not something that I'm often doing. So that was funny, right? Like when people would say things like, oh, well, you Catholics, you have to obey everything the Pope says. That would make me sort of feel my Catholicism more intensely and then correct them. But also all of that made me seek out specifically Catholic spaces. So that's when I got involved with the Catholic Worker. That's when I got involved with Women's Ordination Conference and Call to Action, because I wasn't in a Catholic space and I wanted to understand who I was as a Catholic, because I was studying interreligious engagement at Union. That was my concentration. And I know that you can most effectively do interfaith or interreligious work from a grounded perspective, from a place of being grounded in your own tradition and your own understanding of who you are. So, you know, I was in all these ecumenical and interfaith spaces, some of which were really nourishing, like the community I lived in. I lived in a women's interfaith community. Some of them were not so nourishing, but since I was doing all this interfaith stuff, I sort of realized, well, I need a good sense of who I am too. So I went out and sought that out.
Yeah. Good. Let's talk about all of the stuff you've been doing with CTA, Call to Action. It seems like, especially in 2020, Abby Rampone just like came out guns blazing with CTA and the rest of the team. Can you tell us about that movement that's been happening recently with Call to Action?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I first got involved with Call to Action in 2018 through the Regeneration Program, which is a program for Catholic young adults aged 20 to 39. And that was a really transformative experience for me personally. And after I did that, a couple years afterwards, actually beginning in the beginning of 2020, I was brought onto staff. And in my professional capacity with Call to Action, my role is communications and activities coordinator. So the reason you see my name in a lot of places is because I send out the emails and I put content on the website and I manage social media and all of those things. But the other side of that is the activities. And the big activity that we had in 2020 was something that we called the National Campaign, which was an effort to coordinate Call to Action's work across geographies and across strategies. We were really trying to get people to think strategically about how to do change in the church and in the world. So we were drawing on things like movement ecology, themes of movement ecology. We were drawing on Adrian Murray Brown's emergent strategy. And we were looking at cultivating a movement that was more deliberate, essentially, more grounded, more conscious of what different people bring to the table and how those things fit together. So we had this grand plan of what that was going to look like in 2020. And then nothing went as planned in 2020, right? We wanted to do a lot of in-person stuff. We wanted to have a more material campaign. We wanted to do actually occupations in churches. And we wanted to have a very issue-driven campaign where people would come from different strategies. They would use direct action, or they would use lobbying or education or alternatives. Those were our four strategies. And they would use them all toward a common goal. And everything got sort of thrown out the window, basically. But what we ended up doing was a campaign that culminated in Advent. And I think of it sort of as a way for our movement to practice thinking strategically, even though we did not do it in a way that made a shared common demand with like a singular voice, right? We did a lot of different things in Advent, but we did so in a way that used this framework of different strategies. And I think that's really good practice for us. And I'm hoping that we can use that in the future. So in Advent 2020, we basically just supported members throughout the year working within each strategy to design and implement their own projects. So we had working groups, and we had the 2020 regenerators, the young adults, and many of them were working on their own projects and coordinating among the different groups because some of the projects used more than one strategy. And then in Advent, we just had all of these disparate projects happening at the same time. So we had a lot of things going on. We had the Advent calendar coordinated by some young adults, which you contributed to. Mm-hmm. We had some alternative liturgies.
Yeah.
Queer and trans-led liturgies, a liturgy of lament for Catholics leaving institutional parishes. We had one group organize a COVID-safe action, which involved flyering and wheat pasting at Catholic parishes.
Right.
Yeah, talking about ordination justice. And we had a couple of lobbying projects, one of which was recently featured in NCR, National Catholic Reporter, about these anti-racist scorecards that one of our young adults designed. They're bishop accountability cards that rank bishops' statements on race, immigration, and policing, and which are intended to use for use to call the bishops to account and encourage them to make stronger statements and take stronger action. So we had all of those things come together in Advent. Advent was the culmination of the national campaign. We used themes of waiting, of birth, of all of the themes of Advent. We tried to connect them to the work that we were doing in the campaign and sort of make clear to our members that we are bringing all of these projects to life in this moment, but that the work of bringing God into the world continues past Advent.
And you did it. It was a tremendous accomplishment, Abby. I mean, really, to you and the team, as a person who watched it, it was tremendous. It was a tremendous accomplishment. And yeah, if that's practice, look out when it's real playtime.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think of all of our work as practicing, right? I don't mean to say that it's not the real deal. It is the real deal, but I just mean to say that we're going to keep doing it. We're going to keep working out the kinks and using this framework again and again and again, like strengthening our muscles essentially.
Awesome. And you are involved with Women's Ordination Conference as well.
Yeah, that's right.
In fact, you went to Rome on behalf of Women's Ordination Conference in 2018.
I went to Rome. I'm on the board of Women's Ordination Conference, and I joined a group of people from Women's Ordination Conference there for that, but actually Call to Action sponsored me to go.
That was
when I was a regenerator, a young adult with Call to Action. So they supported me to travel and do that work with WAC.
What was it like to be in Rome in 2018 for that event?
It was eye-opening. It was powerful. So the event was the opening of the Synod on Young People, the Faith, and Vocational Discernment. So WAC organized a series of events with some other primarily European Catholic feminist organizations. There was a symposium a day or two before the opening of the Synod. There were some talks, there was a panel, and all of those things were fabulous. I loved connecting with women and connecting with activists from all over the world, really. But the real highlight was a protest that we had outside the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, which is where the synod was happening. So it's right outside St. Peter's Square, and we gathered, WAC and representatives from many other Catholic women's groups gathered. And this was as many of the bishops and cardinals and various people who were invited into the synod were walking in.
Yeah.
And we had this protest. It wasn't specifically about women's ordination. It was about votes for Catholic women, because we were calling attention to the fact that they had recently changed the rules so that the unordained heads of male religious orders would have voting rights at the synod. So they would be able to weigh in on the final document. But their counterparts, the female heads of religious orders, were also not ordained, could not vote. So there's no reason for it aside from sexism, right? It's a pretty easy entrance point to, even for somebody who's not in favor of ordination, right? You can point to that and say, hey, this is messed up, and there's no good reason for you to say that the unordained heads of male religious orders can vote, but the women can't.
Yeah.
So that's what we were calling attention to. And the protests got a lot of coverage in international media because we had a sort of a face-off with the Roman police and got our passports confiscated. And they sort of showed up. Some of them showed up on horseback, showed up with their police cars and dispersed things, but not before we managed to do a lot of chanting and make a lot of noise, basically.
Great. Good for you. And they took your passports and then what? They ran around the block and then gave them back to you?
They took our passports and you know, by doing that, they were effectively detaining us, right? Because we couldn't leave if they had our passports. I think they took photos of them. Nothing ever happened to us, but it was stressful. Yeah. I saw one of the police officers sort of wrest or grab a cell phone away from a young woman from Prague who was trying to live stream everything. And there was a photo of one of the police officers grabbing the arm of Kate McAlee, Walk's executive director. So it was pretty tense.
It sounds like it.
Mm-hmm.
So Abby, there's people listening who are like, you going to Rome, you're almost getting arrested, all for this church that clearly has said over and over again from its official rankings, we don't want you. We're not mm-hmm. going to do it. Thanks for coming, but not really. And never mind, we're not doing it. So
right.
What is your answer to the question? Why stay Catholic? Can you find spiritual fulfillment any other way?
It's a good question. I've had so many different answers to that question over the years. I think that part of it is that it's my inheritance. It's that this is the tradition that my family has practiced through generations and generations. And I think that means something. I think much of my family is Italian, and I have a grandmother who is from Bavaria, very Catholic parts of the world. And I know that my family has practiced Catholicism for centuries, right? So I feel that part of it is that I have an obligation. I have an obligation not to abdicate my responsibility as somebody who has inherited this church, which is a beautiful thing. I think it means something very powerful to practice something that has been handed down to me. But also I think that by sticking around and not running off when the going gets tough, I'm trying to make things better because I also have this responsibility that I've inherited, because the Catholic Church has done a lot of harm, and the Catholic Church isn't going away. If I leave, the Catholic Church isn't going to dissolve. So I think that personally, I feel an obligation to stick it out, to not say, oh, the church has done all these horrible things in the name of God, and therefore I don't want anything to do with it. Because I've inherited that, whether I like it or not, right? Things have been done in my name, conquest and colonization. These are things that I benefit from. I benefit from the church's actions as a white person, whether or not I say that I belong to the Catholic Church. So I feel that I have an obligation to work in that space. I think that's one of the particularly powerful things for me, but I feel such a deep connection to so much of the tradition, to the saints, specifically to the Catholic Worker Movement now. I feel what this church can be, So it's not just a self-sacrificing thing, right? It's not just because I feel that it's an obligation, even though I do. It's also that I love a lot of things about being Catholic. So I stick around for myself too.
Me too. Tell us about Vermont. You're there now, yeah?
Yes, I'm in Vermont. I'm in my childhood home in Vermont.
Awesome. Tell us about your parish in Vermont.
Well, I attend a very small church in Vermont. It is a small diocesan parish that is really shrinking and some might say dying. It's a primarily older population. There are about 4,000 people in my town. And on any given Sunday, this is pre-pandemic, you probably have about 30, 40 people in the church, which can seat much more than that. And there aren't very many young people. And there aren't very many people in general. There aren't very many young families. And the church has been combined with four other churches in the area. So there are four rural churches that are now under the care of an order called the Society of Divine Vocations, which is a missionary order, primarily from the Global South. So we have had a series of priests over the past 10 years or so that this has been set up from Nigeria and the Philippines and India, who come and they live in community in the next town over. So we don't have a priest in our rectory at my church. And they, usually there's two or three priests in the next town over, and they drive around and pastor the four churches. So I feel like with that setup now, right, with fewer priests, with this society, which moves its priests around a lot, so we don't have any of them for much more than 2 years. It's further contributed to the breakdown of the parish life.
Mm. Abby, should you be the pastor of that church?
You know, I it's funny. It's weird to sit in mass and listen to priests give a homily and be able to say, oh, that's not quite right, or that's not, I disagree with that interpretation, and think it, but I feel like I'm sort of an intruder. I'm like a secret mole listening in with my seminary education. So in some ways I have the training. Yes, I have some of the training to be a pastor of a church. I'm not totally sure that I feel called to ordination. It's something I've wondered.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, I'm not one of those people who always dreamed of being a priest, but then sometimes I wonder if it's just outside my imagination because I've been taught that I can't imagine it. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure, but personally, I don't really feel that I'm called to stay in this town. I think that there are a lot of ways that I would love to serve people in rural areas. I understand a lot of the things that people deal with in terms of rural poverty and the unique struggles that faith communities deal with. But it's, in some ways it's hard. It's hard to be home right now during the pandemic in this town of 4,000. You know, I went to school with the same people kindergarten through 12th grade. And, you know, they're on a personal level, there's a big part of me that just wants to build a new home somewhere else. So
yeah,
I'm not totally sure. I'm not totally sure where I'm called to be, I guess.
Yeah. What's working for you these days in terms of like prayer and discernment and discerning your call and stuff like that? Like what sorts of practices help you and might help our listeners?
Well, I don't know if I have anything that is particularly useful to others. I hate Zoom stuff. I'm so sick of it. I can never make myself go to optional Zoom events, optional Zoom services, or even lectures that I'm super interested in. And I just can't make myself do it. I find it exhausting. Mm-hmm. But I'm and I want social interaction. I want community time, but I'm really struggling to find a way to worship with others. So really my practice, if it exists right now, is pretty interior. I read a lot. I've read a lot of, I'm trying to think. I've definitely read a lot during the pandemic. Made my way through the edited volume of Dorothy Day's Diaries, The Duty of Delight, which is pretty hefty. That feels like spiritual practice. Mm-hmm. And I sew a lot. I do a lot of cross stitching. That's been something I've taken up during the pandemic. That feels very, very nourishing to me. And I pray haphazardly. I pray as I go through my day. I pray as I walk down the street, usually, like when I'm in New York. It's really just a rhythm in my head of saying the Hail Mary in my head, for instance, again and again and again. Mm. It just sort of comes into my head. I'm not good at making time to sit down and pray. But it just sort of comes out of me, I think, throughout the day.
Yeah. So Abby, as you look to the future, what do you see? And take that however you want, personally or communally. What are some things that you are seeing on the horizon, like in the activist Catholic community?
Right. Well, we're all trying to figure things out during the pandemic, but on CTA's front, I'm very excited for a second year of this campaign model that we've had. We're going to run the same thing again in 2021 with some modifications. We have two regeneration programs this year, which I'm really excited that we can offer. One is a cohort of local teams, and one is a cohort specifically for people of color. So I'm very excited that Call to Action can offer that. Personally, I'm trying to figure out where I fit, looking for different options about where I'll go, where my next steps will be. But in terms of my specific interests in activism, I'm really looking at how I can more thoroughly integrate my commitment to the Catholic worker and my commitment to progressive Catholic spaces, because they are very different in a lot of ways. And I feel an affinity for them for different reasons and in different ways. Mm-hmm. And so I would really love to see the progressive Catholic movement take on a more materialist approach. We are largely a group of middle class or upper middle class people, many of us with master's degrees or higher. We are a very erudite bunch, which has its place. And it's also a very white space, and we've been reckoning with that in inadequately, but we've been trying to for years now. But I don't think that I don't think we'll address racism adequately unless we also address class. If we don't talk about class and about material needs, and if we keep all of our efforts in the clouds, I think we're missing what's right in front of us. So I want to figure out how I can really feel like I'm doing something cohesive in my activism, rather than putting on a different hat in my progressive Catholic space and putting on a different hat in my radical Catholic worker space. Mm-hmm. I think that both spaces have things that they can learn from each other and need to learn from each other. So that's something that I'm personally looking at right now and trying to figure out.
So cool. I can't wait to see what comes.
Thanks.
And let's put in the show notes, I'll put a link to the
Regeneration.
That's what it is. The regeneration cohorts. And like you said, you're recruiting for two different cohorts for 2021 right now. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. The deadline is February 19th.
Okay, rad. Yeah. This episode should come out on February 1st. So that should work out okay.
Perfect.
Folks will have to giddy up and get to that. And I'll put a link about movement ecology and to Adrienne Marie Brown's work and Duty of Delight, all that good stuff that you've recommended that we read and stuff that's really working for you. Let's we'll share that with our listeners.
Awesome.
Yeah. Abby, thank you so much for coming to talk to us on a Mission.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to On a Mission. Get all of the details about this episode at MaleneDupreeDominguez.com. While you're there, make sure you sign up for my weekly email newsletter, which contains prayer tools, cool stuff to read, and links to other progressive, faith-based stuff around the internet. Don't forget to take my reader survey for 2021. Follow me on Instagram and Twitter at @_Malene. Thanks for all your support of the podcast. See you next time.